session. On the agenda today, House Bill 2774 has been deleted from the agenda, and we will go in the order of House Bill 2882, 2739, 2634, and 2009. We will begin House Bill 2882. Now in session, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2882 comes to us from Representative Backlund, and it changes the requirements for establishment of residency for members of the armed forces and their families. There's no revenue impact, and I have not received any info on the fiscal impact. A bill dealing with the same subject, House Bill 2177, has passed through both houses and is awaiting the governor's signature. So I don't know if Representative Backlund wants to speak. Oh, apparently I now have the fiscal on 2882. So, or you do too.
Representative Backlund, you...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've printed, I've had delivered to each of you, I hope, House Bill 2177, which we passed on the 29th of March, so that we could have something to compare very carefully. And beyond that, I'm very interested in hearing what we're going to hear on this bill, on 2882. And we have the young man who brought this to my attention here to testify, so the information that he brings should be very helpful to this committee.
Thank you very much. Jeremiah Ross? Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, my name is Jeremiah Ross, and I'm here to support House Bill 2882. And before I give the background and everything of how this affected me, I think that the big question is, how is this different than House Bill 2177? So I will address that probably first, just to get that out of the way. If you look at, I believe it's line 15 on the B and Gross Bill of 2177, it reads, reside in a foreign country and establish Oregon residency by filing Oregon state income taxes no later than 12 months before leaving active duty. And this would be good and fine, and it would accomplish exactly the same thing as House Bill 2882, except for the fact that reside in a foreign country is put on there. And as we know here, that these five words make all the difference, that it runs into a problem of a service member being excluded and not being eligible for this just for the fact that they were not stationed stateside, and they have no, you cannot request where you're going to get stationed. It's pretty much wherever Uncle Sam needs you is where you're going to go. And I really believe that this reside in a foreign country is just, it's not fair to members, say, of the Coast Guard that have no chance of getting stationed overseas, so this bill would not apply to them. But yet if you're in the Air Force and you were sent to Germany, then the bill would apply to you. So it's just an unfair thing. And I think that House Bill 2882 includes these people, and probably next session it will be taken up, and probably maybe C would be taken out of the statute, because House Bill 2882 does the same thing as 2177, but more. It makes it more fair. You run into the problems also of how are we going to prove that residing in a foreign country, how long do you have to live in the foreign country? It's just going to be a mess, and House Bill 2882 takes care of all these problems. And just a little bit about my background. I joined the military. My father was a naval officer for 23 years, so I never really had a state of origin. I always just was a Navy brat. And so I joined the military when I was 17, had a falling out with my parents, decided to move in with my sister in Oregon about mid-stride. And this was March of 98. I got out of the, I was paying Oregon income taxes. I had a driver's license, vehicle registered in Oregon, and I was voting in Oregon. And I did this on the advice pretty much of a lady at DMV. She said, you don't want to have your stuff scattered all over the place, because at the time my car was registered in Maryland and had a California driver's license that was expired, but in the military you can have expired driver's licenses. It's just one of the things they do. And So I got out of the military, decided to go back to school, applied to U of O. Everything was fine, and then I got accepted, and they came back and revoked my residency. They overturned it just for the fact that I hadn't gone through their things, that you have to actually live in the state of Oregon for a year. That's the main thing to establish residency, is actually being here, physically being here. But that's impossible for a service member due to the fact that they have no choice of where they're going to get stationed. So that's just my background. So I went to Representative Backlund, told him about it, and here we are. Pretty much the problems with the current thing is Oregon does not exempt service members from paying income taxes. Although service members, they get a tax break. It's not a big one, but I couldn't find it in the Oregon revised statute of exactly what it was, but they do pay income taxes, and this creates the problem of paying for services that they're excluded from. You could have a career serviceman that's been paying Oregon income taxes for 30 years and wants to send his daughter or son to university when they get out of the military, and they're going to say, sorry, you have to pay the out-of-state tuition, put your life on hold for a year, and work, and then maybe your daughter or son can get the in-state tuition. I don't think that that's pretty fair. And then the problems with the driver's license, you can go to the DMV, you can get a driver's license, you can do these things, but it's just this law would do. It would make it easier. It would grant privileges. It would not be a special privilege. It would just accommodate these members' lifestyles, the service members' lifestyles, because they do live a nomadic lifestyle. You don't really have a home. You have a place where you're stationed and stuff like that, and you have a place that you're going to return to eventually. And you might not see that place as I didn't see the West Coast for 2 years, but I still call it the West Coast home. And these driver's license law saying that you can have a driver's license and it can be expired, I think that was put in there just to accommodate this nomadic lifestyle, just as this bill should do the same. And members are also able to register their vehicles through the mail, and they're not same thing. They're given a little exemption. They don't have to be smogged or anything. And I found it kind of odd when I was looking into this that if it came to collecting fees or anything like that, the state was more than willing to accommodate them. But when it came to this, that actually collecting the money from those fees, then the state is not as willing as they would with these other three things that all involve collecting fees. And the main thing is the criteria for residency is establishing a domicile in the state that you wish to reside in. This creates problems for service members. Many have no choice of where they're going to get stationed, and the odds of requesting to be transferred to Oregon and actually being transferred to Oregon to the state is very unlikely. And the reason this is unlikely, if not impossible, because Oregon does not have any major military bases. Unless you're in the Coast Guard, you're pretty much not going to get stationed in Oregon, or a recruiter. Service members are legally bound to a contract, and they just go where they're told. Unlike civilians, they do not have the option to quit and get another job just to move. This is where the current law causes problems. Service members are pretty much confined to the state they joined from or were stationed during their service. And once they get out, they can be asked to take a year out of their life to establish residency or pay the $10,000, as I was told. I could pay the $10,000 extra a year is what out-of-state tuition runs. And I'm sure if they're in the service, they probably don't have that kind of money, so that's not really feasible. And how many people is this bill going to affect? We're talking maybe one, two people a year. I talked to the VA representative at U of O, and she said that over the past few words was her words, that she heard of one lady that went through this, and she moved down to California just because their out-of-state tuition is cheaper than Oregon. So Oregon probably lost a good student there. And this is just, Oregon doesn't have to worry about massive amounts of service member changing their residency. Just lots of people flock to California and Florida and the military because they don't charge income tax to service members. And I think that's another reason that I wouldn't have any basis for this if Oregon didn't charge income taxes. But just because of that, Oregon has some of the highest income taxes in the country, so why would a service member just go to pay extra money unless they actually want to be here? And of these service members that House Bill 282 affects, only those who fish, hunt, and want to pursue higher education will actually see the benefits. So if you do this, all this stuff, and you transfer your residency, just on chance, it's probably going to affect you. No one researches Oregon revised statutes or revised statutes probably before they move to a place. At least I didn't, and I haven't heard of anyone. So by chance, this will just affect them. And of the people it does affect, it's only going to, the people that actually use it are the people that fish, hunt, and want to pursue higher education, which is not all people in the military. A lot of guys just get out, they go get a regular job and do the 9-to-5 thing. And the big one, how much is it going to cost? I really don't think it's, I'm sure you guys have the fiscal impact statement, but it's probably pretty minimal. And I really can't see the Oregon Department of Fish and Game noticing their decline in revenue from the sale of out-of-state fishing license and hunting licenses. And I don't think that this is going to strain the Department of Higher Education and lost revenue that they would get from a service member paying out-of-state tuition. And that's pretty much all I have to say on that.
Thank you.
Pardon. Hopefully you guys have some questions for me. Clear this up.
Questions? Representative Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today. You know, when I was in the service, I grew up in Oregon, so I was an Oregon resident, and I always retained my Oregon residency, even though I moved to Colorado and Massachusetts and Virginia. And I always maintained my Oregon residency because it was a good state to be from for tax purposes, because I didn't have to pay any income tax. And the rule, as I recall, and I'm looking in the statutes and don't find it, is unless you're in the state for more than 30 days a year, if you're a full-time service member, you're exempt from state tax. Isn't that still the case?
I tried to look that up too, sir, and I was looking at 341 and 316 in that area. And then ORS, like 410, I believe, is the one that has to do with veterans. And I couldn't find it. And from my personal experience, I paid in 1998, I paid $113 in Oregon income taxes, and which is a small amount, but I was only making $11,000 that year. So that is.
Have you ever had an accountant tell you had to?
No, and I went through H&R Block when I did my taxes, because they said that Oregon's laws with the tax laws, the lady couldn't even figure it out. So we just basically sent it in, and Oregon took $113.82, I believe it was, something like that. And I tried to find it, sir, but I was unable to actually find where it exempts people. And I know, I believe California is the same way. You don't get taxed unless you're actually in the state. But I know from my personal experience, maybe it was a mistake, but Oregon did take money from me.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
It's certainly possible they've changed. I'm willing to bet you, though, that the rule still is that if you're not in this state for more than 30 days a year and you're a member of the armed forces, you don't have to pay state income tax. I mean, the way it works is, for people in the service, is that as you're stationed from place to place, you can establish residency either where your original domicile was, which in my case was Oregon, or any place that you've happened to stay for more than a year. And a lot of people kind of shop around for a favorable state to be from. For example, I think Texas has favorable income tax statutes for military members. And the original bill made somewhat sense, because if somebody's overseas, they have less of a connection. But I'm not sure I understand the rationale for 2882 in allowing people that have really never been in Oregon to decide that this is where they want to come for purposes of higher ed. I mean, I think the reason we give residents lower tuition is because they have a connection with the state and they have a history of paying taxes, and I think this goes against that. I mean, people, we would be giving that incentive to people who've never lived here before. And in your case, it's kind of unusual because you were a brat. So,
yes, sir.
So you don't have a domicile. You didn't grow up in a state, and your parents didn't have a history of paying state taxes. But I think in general, is what we're doing is we're establishing a policy so that people that have never had a connection with the state of Oregon can come here and take advantage of resident tuition. And I'm not sure that makes sense.
May I address that?
Yes, you may.
Sure.
Pretty much, sir. I can see where you're coming from, sir, but as you said, people do...
Don't call me sir. I'm not in the military anymore.
If you drive, say, your state of Washington, you drive to California, you drive through Oregon, you say, hey, this is a place, as many people do, it's a beautiful state. I want to get out and move to Oregon. When the average person, they could just pick up and move to Oregon, say, hey, I like the people. And when you're in the military, this is not possible. And just, I think that just as they do with the driver's license, vehicle registration, this bill would not make people disconnected or anything. I think it would just accommodate them and make them eligible. Because you have this real weird society that the military is that doesn't really have the same laws and doesn't have the same privileges and stuff that everyday civilians have. And currently, I think that they should be able to move wherever they want. They should be able to establish this. For this 12 months clearly shows that of paying income taxes, and I know this is debatable, but I know I paid income taxes. I'll swear that I have paid $113 in income taxes.
I believe you.
I wish I had the form here, but I believe that that's showing intent, that they want to be a part of this state, and they want to do. I don't see the difference between them doing that and coming here on leave, spending their two weeks in Oregon, rather than just saying living in Medford, being working at McDonald's or something like that. I really don't see that. There's a big difference. I think that these people are doing an honorable thing. And they shouldn't be excluded from establishing a residency because it's impossible for them to do. It's impossible. You're lost. Pretty much, I had no connection to California because or Oregon because I was gone for so long. You come home for 3 months, you don't know who runs the government. You don't know really anything. You know about where you're at. And you pretty much, I didn't know anything about, I didn't even know the county I was stationed in North Carolina for a year and a half just because that's how disconnected you are from the rest of the world.
Any other questions? Representative Shetterly.
I was just curious to know if you had followed House Bill 2177 through either the House or the Senate, following the discussions on that, because they may very well have had these same conversations, and if you tried to amend House Bill 2882 into 2177 as it was going through on the House or Senate.
Yes, sir, and I did follow 2177, and I wish I would have been there for the committee hearing, but I had school. I'm a full-time student, and as much as this affects me and stuff, like I think my grades are a little more important. I had a test that day, so Ed Hughes and Colonel Caldwell from the Veterans, they were the ones that tried to shove this amendment in along with Representative Morgan because of the same, it does pretty much the same thing, but they didn't realize when they were doing it that to reside in a foreign country would exclude people. And had I had been there, I would have brought it to their attention that this is pretty much, it doesn't really make sense of making someone in a station overseas a little more valuable than someone stationed stateside because they have no choice of where they're going to be thrown.
Madam Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To address Representative Shetterly's question, it was brought to my attention on the floor, actually, before we were to vote on House Bill 2177, of Jeremiah's concerns. And that was the second time. And then just the day before, I had contacted Representative Morgan and left a message with Senator Messerly expressing Jeremiah's concerns on his behalf, anyway. And it was kind of too late to, frankly, I guess, to deal with it at that time. And And you'll notice, or you'll recall, that House Bill 2177 had widespread support and passed 56-0 in the House. And Jeremiah was gone last week, as was my legislative assistant, who were the two who really worked together very closely on this. So the timing was not advantageous for us to try to fold 2177 and 2882 into something that Jeremiah would think was a good thing.
Okay. Are you familiar with any of the other states as to how they handle this?
I tried to look that up, ma'am, and I couldn't find it. I looked at just random states, Illinois and Texas, and I really couldn't find anywhere in their statutes where it basically addressed this. I tried to look on the Internet, and most states don't have their revised statutes on the Internet to look, but I did try to look, and I really couldn't find anything that I could find.
As a member of the military, did you attempt to attend school in another state?
No, I was a infantryman that was, we were gone 2 or 3 weeks at a time. School was an impossibility for myself. So,
I have a long line of military family members as well, but usually they were able to attend the state where they were stationed as a resident within that state. They didn't have to pay out-of-state tuition. I just wondered if you'd run into that.
No, ma'am. But that is the case in most states, that if you're stationed there, you're granted the in-state tuition.
Thank you. Any further questions? No? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Grant and Kern.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Grant and Kern, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, having distributed the engrossed House Bill 2177. If you don't have that in front of you, we worked with Colonel Caldwell of the Oregon Military Department on House Bill 2177, and we were in agreement with him that the need to make an amendment regarding reserve and National Guard members should be effectuated. The bill was amended at our request on line 10 to say that the members of that family who reside in this state, they also have that benefit. When it went over to pass the House, went over to the Senate, Representative Morgan brought to the attention of the committee a case which we were familiar with of a person who was stationed overseas, who had come to Oregon to live for about 4 months before entering the service, lived with his father in Josephine County, then entered the Marines and went overseas. Young man is returning, made contact with Southern Oregon University, found out that under the law would not qualify. Even with 2177, will not qualify as a resident. And so she sent an amendment over, which resulted in the be engrossed House Bill 2177 with the amendments on lines 14 and 15, which the Oregon University System concurred in. We did not object, and said that although that is, very often you can make mistakes by creating general law from an individual case, we felt that the legislature had every right to make that amendment if they wished. We did not see a particular downside to it, although it does have a fiscal impact. We thought it would be relatively minor. Now comes House Bill 2882, and again we have a situation which is creating a general rule based upon case, and here, although we have to say that it's up to you, you're the ones that make these residency requirements. It's our job to implement them and see that they are fairly implemented for individuals who come. I want to create, if I can, just a minute, and a picture for you that would give you some idea of our concern. Some years ago, the legislature determined that people who are residents of Washington could have resident tuition at Oregon community colleges. Border counties have resident tuition, come across, fill the seats, receive state support for those FTE, seemed like a good idea. The Higher Education Coordinating Board of Washington, in just a couple of months ago, completed a study of that law and its impact and found that there were 8,000 FTE Washingtonians attending in Oregon, 732 FTE Oregonians attending in Washington, for a net loss of around $4 million a biennium. Now, that's a choice of the legislature to underwrite those FTE. But we're of the opinion that in terms of the Oregon University system, at about $5,500 per resident FTE in state support, you would need to be careful in generalizing to all the military personnel of all the armed forces anywhere in the United States who have never resided in Oregon and had no previous connection with the state, and who by filing an Oregon income tax and thus overriding the exemption granted to military personnel in the year before they arrive, provide that opportunity. Again, your choice. But the only warning we would have is if you do consider this and you do support it and you do wish it to be enacted, that it be sent to the Ways and Means Committee, that its fiscal impact be very carefully examined, and we get an idea of what the actual impact is. I'm certain when you granted resident tuition status to Washingtonians in border counties that you never thought that would be 8,000 FTE, 10 times that of those Oregonians going north. The same, I would suspect, could be true here, although we do not know. And it's not because we are not interested in having members of the military achieve a higher education. And we have certainly supported House Bill 2177 at each step. But I do want to caution you that I believe this has an expanded impact far beyond what 2177 has and could be quite dramatic given the fact that for each of those FTE who come and have full-time status, it costs the general fund about $5,500. And these are for folks who have decided to come here for purposes of higher education, hunting and fishing licenses, without any other previous attachment to the state. So, happy to answer any questions you might have about our residency policies or how they are implemented, if you have any.
Any questions? I just have one. Military personnel who may be stationed here, are they required to pay out-of-state tuition?
No, Madam Chair. If you look at Section 1 of ORS 174-103, officers and enlisted personnel of the Armed Forces of the United States who are here, reside in the state, while assigned to duty at any base, station, shore establishment, or other facility in the state, are already by law granted that exemption. I mean, so they pay resident tuition.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Grattan, I certainly appreciate your concern and defense of the Oregon University system. That's obviously very important. Do you have a reaction to Jeremiah's comment that based on his examination, there's only a very small number of people, perhaps one or very few? You would disagree with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Backlund, yes, although we can't quantify it, and the bill does move, we, as I say, we'd prefer to have it in the Ways and Means Committee and subject it to some significant analysis and look at it in relationship to other states. In effect, you're saying to anyone who is stationed in any of the other 49 states that by the simple act of filing an income tax return once in the 12 months before you decide to reside here and register to vote, you are granted immediate residency for purposes of tuition. That's no small benefit from a state which provides and a tremendous attraction to those who wish to come here. We started the decade in the top five states for in-migration and ended in the top 10. We will continue to do that. We are a very attractive place to live. And it's up to you to determine who has resident tuition. That's your task. But we suspect that that would be, over time, a very attractive inducement to come here. And I'm trying to say as politely as I can that given the history of the action you took relative to non-resident resident tuition for community colleges, this one could very well be of similar magnitude, greater, but certainly no small impact.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Okay. I received a statement on House Bill 2882 from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that will be entered into the record. They state that they are neutral on the bill. Hearing is closed on House Bill 2882. We are not going into work session on that one at this time. Open the hearing on House Bill 2739. Council, give us a summary, please.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2739 authorizes the establishment of pet trusts for the care of designated domestic or pet animals upon the owner's death or incapacity, and there is no revenue impact or no fiscal impact on this.
Thank you. We had a dog here to testify, but it had to leave. I'm sure it will submit written testimony. Okay, thank you. Sharon Harmon. Gary Kish is with you. You come up? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. My name is Sharon Harmon. I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Humane Society. We're here in support of House Bill 2739. We really feel that pet ownership is a responsibility that carries from not only when you're alive, but until after you're gone. Just because you're gone doesn't mean that pet still doesn't need care. More and more people are concerned about the welfare of their animals. They're certainly concerned about their animals after they're gone. We certainly see that in requests for assistance. Our office helps people plan for the care of their pets through their wills, and we believe House Bill 2739 will help make these pet trusts enforceable. At this point, with your permission, Madam Chairman, I would like Gary Kish, who's our Director of Development for the Oregon Humane Society, to explain the bill in a little more detail, and then if that's okay, I would like to come back and finish up my testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We really appreciate this opportunity to speak before you and present House Bill 2739. I am Gary Kish, Director of Development for the Oregon Humane Society. And in the course of my work, I frequently speak with persons about estate planning, and within that topic, the matter of surviving pets comes up. And I've been in this position for 10 years, and I've watched this topic become increasingly, shall we say, popular amongst people and estate planning attorneys. This bill merely ensures that people's wishes with respect to their pets and delineated in a trust document will actually be carried out. Seems like a simple concept, so why do we need this bill? Well, under current Oregon law, pet trusts now fall under the category of an honorary trust. It's kind of like suggested. They are not enforceable, and if the trustee designated in the trust chooses not to carry out their actions, there's nothing anyone, including the courts, can do about this. So House Bill 2739 just codifies pet trusts so that they are enforceable like any other trust document. And by doing that, we're able to make sure that the owner's intent gets honored. I'd like to list just a couple benefits of the of this bill to conclude my testimony. The main benefit is that it creates certainty for pet owners who, after acting responsibly and setting up provisions for the care of their pets in a trust, that their intent will actually be honored. By enabling pet owners to provide for surviving pets with some certainty, this bill may incrementally reduce the number of pets coming into private and municipal animal shelters, which would reduce the expense on those shelters. A category of persons that may really be benefited by this bill is senior citizens. In the course of our work, we often come upon seniors who would really like to have a pet. Oftentimes, they're living alone. Perhaps all their friends have passed away. They'd really like to have a pet, but they're really concerned about what would happen to the pet should they, you know, predecease the pet. Well, this would just give them a little more certainty that they could do something to make sure their pets are taken care of. And finally, this just helps to meet the growing demand of pet owners who want to make provisions for the care of surviving pets. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, should there be any.
Thank you. Go ahead and finish your testimony, and then I'll take
Thank you for accommodating us here and our little dog and pony show, so to speak.
Oh.
Sorry.
That's a question I was going to ask.
Does
this include dogs and ponies and everything else?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm so sorry that April Fool's fell on a Sunday. It's one of my favorite holidays, but I have to make up for it today. What we're talking about here is allowing a pet owner to carry out their wishes. If Representative Lowe wants McKenna to have Morton steak 3 days a week delivered by chauffeur, then so be it. It's her wishes. It's McKenna's wishes. I bet if you ask McKenna, she'd like that, but it's her wishes. And for a caregiver who's given an amount of money and said, now, we'd like you to take care of this, but under current law, they're only honorary. It's only good intentions. It's only promises made. And the amount of money that Representative Will might put aside to care for McKenna could be tempting for someone to do something else with. A more true-to-life example, well, at least for today, I don't want to, you know, suppose that McKenna would not get Morton steak 3 days a week, is we have a case involving two little Pomeranians that are part of an estate. The decedent put in her will that she wanted a specific individual to care for them. She left a lot of money to care for these dogs. Currently, the trustee gets about $800 a month to care for two geriatric Pomeranians who never see a veterinarian and who are living in a chicken coop. I can only imagine what her thoughts are in heaven looking down to seeing her beloved companions living in a chicken coop. It's not against Oregon law. It's not against our cruelty statutes. They have protection from the sun and the wind and the rain, but it certainly wasn't the intent of the donor. And we have no way to intervene on behalf of the decedent. Her wishes certainly aren't being carried out. We would like to see that these animals get cared for in the manner that the previous owner intended to do, and we want to help them do that. And it really doesn't matter what that care is, how excessive, how extreme. I guess that's for the person to judge. They're their pets. It's their money. We just want to see if those animals get proper care. One point Mr. Kish mentioned about senior citizens. I met with a woman on Friday. She's got an aged poodle. She's in her 80s. And when this poodle goes, she says, "I'm so sorry, but that's going to be my last animal, my last pet." I'm like, "Why?" She says, "Well, who would take care of them after I'm gone? What would give her the certainty?" And promises and good intentions aren't enough. And that's why we need House Bill 2739 to keep that promise, to keep that stewardship, and to keep those animals safe and healthy. Thank you for listening to us this morning.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have some correspondence from the estate, or from the state bar, if I could ask that to be distributed to committee members. It's my bill, and I had a couple of questions, and I think there's some, they're on the table. Proposals for amendment I'd like to work for the next week on, perhaps. But in doing that, I want to ask a couple of questions about the bill. My bill, so of course I think it's a great bill. But let me ask, on line 5 of the bill, and I've drafted a few pet trusts, so I've worked some of these issues through. We have the statement here, a pet trust terminates when no living animal is covered by the trust. What about the situation, and it happens when in fact the trust runs out of assets before the before the beneficiary, in this case the animal, dies. I mean, that's a possibility if a person doesn't fund a trust with enough money to take care of it. Shouldn't we contemplate what might happen in that case as well? I mean, because you can bet it's going to happen that somebody's going to leave their horses, leave a trust for their horses, and veterinary expenses and boarding expenses and the like are going to run out before the horses do, and then what happens? Do we specifically provide in here that the assets for the trust to, you know, to dispose appropriately of the animals or something at the end? What's your thinking there?
Madam Chairman, Representative Shetterly, certainly in the creation of the trust, successive trustees could be assigned, whether that is a person or an agency.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, it's not so much a question of the trustees, it's a question of the assets. The money is gone, but the animals aren't. Then what happens?
Madam Chairman, Representative Shetterly, where I was going with that was that they could be assigned to an animal welfare agency, to a rescue group that would care for them in the manner that they customarily do. For some of these pets, there may be a future. For some of them, they, like the trust themselves, may have simply run out of time. But we'd like to see the intent of the donor or the beneficiary or benefactor, one of those categories, honored through this trust. But I can appreciate your concern, what happens with. They may have grandiose plans.
Right.
Morton Steak may be in McDonald's, but then what if the money does run out? I think those are thoughts to be considered.
And Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Another one, and yeah, we'll have to deal with that, but another one is in Section 2, Subsection 2, where it refers to the court may appoint a person. We've got this. The terms and conditions of the pet trust may be enforced by an individual designated for that purpose in the trust instrument. As I understand from my correspondence with the bar and with Alan Jensen, that is somebody actually other than the trustee. This is somebody kind of watching to make sure that the trustee is doing the trustee's job. Is that what you understood that to be?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then it says if the court may appoint a person for that purpose if the trust doesn't designate that. I'm just curious whether you had in mind, would that be a compensated role? If the court is going to appoint somebody, is somebody going to be, is that an expense that would be drawn out of the trust to pay for a person to have that function?
Madam Chairman, Representative Shetterly, the court could decide that. In our experience, some of the trustees are compensated. Some are entitled to be compensated but choose not to take the compensation. In some cases, it is simply the benefit goes to the pet. But I would imagine that the court could intercede and pay just reasonable and just expenses.
Again, I would just, Madam Chair, refer the committee to some comments in a letter from Alan Jensen. I'd like to work with Mr. Hendricks in the next week or so and maybe incorporate some of these along with some suggestions Mr. Hendricks had in and get this good and worthy bill back so we can
move it through. Madam Chair?
Thank you. Representative Backlund?
It occurred to me, what does this bill affect a situation that could arise, say the pet trustee has an animal and the animal is bred? What about the offspring? Would they be affected by this?
Madam Chairman, Representative Backlund, I'm unclear as to whether it could be linear in that fashion. It would.
I'm not sure either. So the pet trustee has been entrusted for the financial well-being of this animal, and someone has agreed to do that. The pet is bred. Could the person in charge of the dog sell the offspring for personal profit, whatever?
Madam Chairman, Representative Backlund, one of the provisions that we've encouraged pet owners to take is to microchip their pets and otherwise permanently identify them. You can be sure the two little Pomeranians are microchipped, so this stops when it stops. Gary, did you have?
Well, I was just going to say, in answer of your question, I think it would depend on how the trust document was drafted. That provision could be made. Otherwise, I think if the trust document was silent to that, then it would only cover the animal that was intended.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
Yeah, I think a lot of this could be will be answered by the way the trusts are drafted. I think in the bill we want to create a framework. I don't think we want to create necessarily the provisions of each trust. Although your question is a good one, it does raise the issue of whether we need to contemplate David Hendricks creating a rule against perpetuities applicable to animals.
That's what I was thinking,
would have
wondering.
Shorter than lives and being plus 21 years, because that's a lot of dogs.
See that one in court.
Dave Hendricks, Legislative Council. Technically, what they're talking about in the law is whether or not they can create a tail.
Oh!
Oh, thank you.
Madam Chair, my downward spiral vortex continues.
Any other question or comment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
Sorry to digress with a serious note here.
Oh.
Sorry. It seems to me that a pet trust is great policy until it becomes taking care of Fifi's offspring and their offspring and their offspring, and that's not good policy. And I would just throw that out and for drafting purposes. I don't think that really serves anybody, and I would not like to see things go that way.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and maybe we can deal with this, the language that was proposed and is in the bill. It says, can create a pet trust for the care of designated domestic or pet animals, and I think the intention there is to make the trust specific to identified animals as opposed to just an ongoing trust for generations.
Well, I agree. Well, I think
so. We can clarify that, I think, with the amendments too, that it be designated.
I would like to suggest too, in working on the amendments, that sometimes people keep these animals and purebred animals for breeding purposes. So if they have some that they know they're going to be whelping pups, and they want those pups taken care of, maybe you need to make some provision for saying that those will be sold or whatever, you know. I mean, that's a consideration, because if they're in it for breeding purposes and they're well-bred, valuable animals, I don't know if we need to do that, but that might be something to consider anyway. Okay, and thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? McKenna left the room, but she left her left her print.
Oh, Madam Chair, is that in support of?
That's obviously
supportive. Okay. An
affirmative print here.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if this bill could be amended to provide for alternative care when one's husband is going to be gone for a week and the dog is going to be left at home.
Sure.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I hate to bring up one last comment. Actually, Representative Lowe gets the credit. No. What about pet turtles that live, say, 300 years?
It was a choke, Vic.
Oh. Well, we're working on amendments, I think that needs to be considered.
I tell you right now, I never had a pet turtle that lived that long in captivity.
I don't know
make
how
it very long.
Pet turtles live, but certainly they have the long lives. Yeah? In any case.
Galapagos turtles do live 300 years.
Any of us that have had children have had a myriad of pets, and some of them are rather exotic. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2739, and we will wait for a work session pending those amendments that have been discussed. I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 2634.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2634 comes to you from Representative Jensen, and it allows a person who has applied for a license to request a contested case hearing before another agency if that agency has shared info with the original agency. I received information from revenue that there is no revenue impact. I did talk to the fiscal person on this, and we discussed the fact that there could be some unintended fiscal implications, that she was still gathering information. You will see that there are dash one amendments that come from Representative Jensen's office to remove DOJ support enforcement license suspension program from the bill. Otherwise, I'll defer to Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. With me is Mr. Hendricks from Legislative Council, who drafted the bill at my request. Perhaps with a couple of revisions to it as we were going through, I would first of all like to thank the Child Support Division and the Department of Justice for the timeliness with which they approached our office in being able to try to deal with and adopt the amendments. I understand that there will be other testimony from the Department of Justice and the Governor's office that will have some different slant, and I would have to say, Madam Chair, that I resent the fact that we wait until the very last second before the author of the bill had any idea that the governor's office had any sort of problem or issue to do with the bill. So with that, let me say that the issue came to me from a constituent issue. And originally, it probably had been my intention to address it toward a specific agency within government. But as we thought about that, it appeared to me that perhaps the issue might be more widespread and that public policy might be better served if we made a more generic case rather than a specific agency or agencies. The issue that appeared had to do with Inland Land Company and its attempt to extend water rights. As some of you are perhaps aware, water rights are granted by the Water Resource Department, and then they need to be perfected. And the water right, at least surface water rights, you have 5 years to perfect those rights. And if you do not get them perfected within a five-year period of time, you may go back to the department and seek extensions of those water rights for another 5 years. In the case of Inland Land, we were talking about a major development, and 5 years for a major agricultural development is a relatively short period of time. So when Inland went back to Water Resource Department to extend their water rights, the Department of Fish and Wildlife became involved as a consultant to the Water Resource Department, and the Fish and Wildlife kept in the negotiations saying no, and the constituent had basically no recourse to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They had the appearing before the Water Resource Department, but Water Resource Department was unwilling to move as long as Fish and Wildlife was as long as their comfort zone wasn't there. It was my contention and is my contention here today that constituents, citizens of the state have or should have a right to go to that agency that is affecting the outcome or result and go to the, in this case, the governing body of the agency, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, to have a hearing there to say, tell us basically what your problem is. And so that's the historical background of where we started out with this bill. Other than that, as far as the technicalities are concerned, I would, given the nature of the Judiciary Committee, bow to your wisdom as far as the technicalities are concerned. And I might ask Legislative Council to give kind of a quick update as to what the bill attempts to do, how it attempts to do it.
Thank you.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The bill 2634 took kind of the broad approach to the problem. It does cover all agencies that are subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, which is the law that governs the manner in which most state agencies provide hearings for people who are seeking licenses or other permits. The bill, you'll notice, talks about licenses. If you go and take a look at the definition of what a license is for the APA, you'll find it covers things like water permits, et cetera. So don't be fooled by the fact that it only talks about licenses. It would cover most permits, certificates, and other things you need to have in order to engage in some sort of activity that you need to get from an agency. And the bill's a little complicated simply because it does need to address the possibility that you have an agency that goes straight to a final order versus a proposed order. But the essential requirement is the same, and that is if Agency A relies upon a factual determination or a recommendation or opinion of another agency in making its decision on the particular application it has in front of it, the bill would allow the applicant, the person seeking the permit or license, to go to the other agency to basically contest that determination. And so the principle, as I understand it, the principle intent was to be able to say, look, if Agency A, you're going to rely on that for making a decision on my case, and I haven't had a chance to challenge that determination in Agency B, I ought to have that opportunity. That's it in a nutshell. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions on the language.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave, I have a question. On line 7, the pertinent language, the application is based on basing any part on an opinion, recommendation, or factual finding at another agency. Does that specifically exclude a rule by another agency? I mean, it doesn't specifically say that, but is that the intent? So that if Agency A is applying the rule of Agency B in making this decision, that's...
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, I think, yes, I don't think there was an intent here to have be able to go over and challenge a rule through a contested case proceeding in the other agency. The intent was to basically say, if the decision made by Agency B was in the nature of something they do in a contested case order on this particular application, rather than attempt to open up policy decisions to other agencies of a broad nature. And rereading the bill again, that's one area where I suppose if you're going to to tighten it up, that that's one place where you might want to look at to make it clear that it has to be some recommendation, decision, et cetera, relating to that, that was directly related to this application.
Relating to that particular license.
That application, yeah.
Madam Chair.
Representative Backlund.
Dave, or Representative Jensen, do you anticipate, if this bill passes in its current form of the dash ones, that there would be a lot of these situations occurring? There's probably no way to tell, but I guess I'll just leave it at that. What is your anticipation, or do you have any?
Chair Walker and Representative Backlund, certainly I don't have a feeling as to the number of cases that might be there, that might be heard. I understood that there's some kind of a revenue impact with this, which must be predicated on some type of anticipation of a lot of cases. And I guess my response to that, if I could, Representative Backlund, is to say that if that is the case, that if there is that huge impact and therefore a lot of cases, then maybe it's a legislation that's long overdue.
Is there Ringo?
This does seem to me like in the example you gave, Representative Jensen, a fairness issue in terms of confronting the person who's really making the important decision. And in your scenario, it seems completely reasonable. Can you give me some other contexts, other examples where this might occur? Either one.
Thank you, Chair Walker, Representative Ringo. And it dawns on me that I never identified myself. Representative Bob Jensen, House District 57, my apologies to the committee. I don't think it, you know, I haven't thought of it in terms of other cases. Just as a point of clarification, I don't know whether you were going there, but I was going to make the clarification. There was no rule in Department of Fish and Wildlife at the time. Subsequently, long after this, there was a rule that would have applied, but not at the time these negotiations were going on.
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, I think one thing that you may see more of is issues of this nature, because in the past, you know, individual agencies dealt with individual problems and didn't have the type of coordination that is being either forced upon them or that they're readily taking on because of problems like salmon and the environmental things, where you are going to have a lot of agencies looking at the same issue, but only one agency really with the statutory authority to make the decision on a permit or a license. And that's where the potential arises for the cooperative sort of venture of making a decision about whether the permit, if agency B says, well, we don't think you should do that because at that point, then you are going to get into those issues about where the responsibility lies for that decision and how do you challenge that decision.
This may be a question that you won't be able to answer, but what I'm looking at here is that sometimes Agency A issues a decision, and they've actually relied upon information from Agency B, but the applicant doesn't know that. Is there any, and maybe it is somewhere else, when these agencies issue their proposed opinions or their final opinions, do they have to disclose the specific reason and where they got that information? That may be beyond the scope of what you considered here, but I would like to know at all.
Chair Walker, at least in the issue that I'm familiar with, the constituent issue that I'm bringing to you, that certainly wasn't the case. I think, and if I understood your question correctly, if an agency refuses some license that I have requested, I assume that it's my responsibility to ask them and go through the process there to inquire of them why you know, they have, and to appeal it within whatever the framework is within that agency.
I just recall some cases that I have been familiar with that when there would be adverse actions in the administrative area that sometimes they'd say we're denying it and just give some kind of a boilerplate reason when actually there was some other reason that was there that the applicant would not know unless they knew specifically to ask those questions. We certainly can't remove all avenues or set up barriers for every circumstance. I just wondered if there was something like that. So, okay.
Sure. The only thing I'd say, Chair Walker, that if you do go to ask for a hearing and go through a hearing, the proposed order that comes out does need to have findings of facts, and those are important because if you appeal, if the applicant appeals the decision, there has to be substantial evidence in the record to support the determination made by the agency. Now, whether or not, you know, that, you know, the finding of facts can be just say, we find this, and there can be plenty in the record beyond what may have been said by Agency B. But if, in fact, we're really relying on Agency B's determination, and that's the only thing they have to support that, that's probably going to show up in their findings of facts.
Another question, administrative process. Can these applicants go in and review that entire file? It's open.
Chair Walker,
in the water resources?
Yeah, yes. Those are all public records, and certainly there are certain discovery provisions for most agencies, although to some degree the agency has a fair amount of control over discovery, but anything that is certainly directly related to the case should be available to any person.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay.
Chair Walker, if yes. I could make just one concluding remark with this. A member of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, when he heard about the legislation that I'm proposing, was enthusiastically supportive of it and regretted that the commission hadn't had a chance to deal with it. That was Commissioner Henry Lorenzen from Pendleton, who is, in his own right, a rather distinguished member of the Oregon Bar Association. So,
thank you. Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, and thank you for hearing our...
Thank you. We have received a written statement from the Oregon Department of Human Services on House Bill 2634 to be entered into the record as part of the testimony. Okay, Renelle Schenkel.
For the record, Ronell Schenkel, Department of Justice, Division of Child Support. My apologies, I do not have written testimony today. In fact, I'm here specifically in support of the Dash 1 amendments. As Representative Jensen indicated, we did meet with him on a couple of occasions, once by phone and once in person. And the flowchart that I'm handing out to the committee is the same flowchart that we provided the representative with to indicate that we already have in place for purposes of child support, license suspension procedures where the parties are entitled to due process and do in fact get an administrative hearing before an administrative law judge. You can find that in two different places on my flow chart. One is on page section 4 of the flow chart where they are appealing our initial notice and intent to do the suspension. And then again in section 5, where perhaps we have entered into an agreement with the party and they were complying for a time and then they ceased to comply, and at that point when we give notice that we are going to suspend, they get another opportunity for a hearing. So I am in support of the Dash 1 amendments, and as a point of clarification, the definition in 25010 would extend to both the Division of Child Support Practitioners and the County District Attorney staff that provide child support program services.
Questions of Ms. Henkel? Thank you very much. Ms. Little.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Little, representing the Oregon Department of Revenue. And under House Bill 2634, as you're aware, a business or a person whose license is suspended or not renewed by a licensing agency could request of the Department of Revenue a contested case hearing from the department. And this presents kind of a problem with the department in that contested case hearing processes do not apply to the Department of Revenue under the APA. And the department requests that, pursuant to House Bill 2634, that it be made not applicable to the Department of Revenue actions that it undertakes under ORS 305-385. And there are two reasons for that request. Again, 305-385 addresses the processes necessary for department license suspension requests and subsequent hearings offered to the licensee by the licensing agency. And I've attached to the back of my testimony a copy of House Bill 30, or of ORS 305-385. And the other reason is that the department is not covered, as I mentioned, under the contested case hearings provisions of Chapter 183, primarily because the Oregon Tax Court has jurisdiction over tax matters. The department does have occasion to request of licensing agencies that a business or occupation license be suspended or not renewed, as authorized by 305-385. The law allows the department to request the suspension of a trade, business, or professional license in an attempt to get a business or a person to comply with the Oregon tax laws. Such suspension requests are rare and done only after the department has exhausted all other means to gain compliance, including requesting voluntary compliance, assessing taxes due, attempting to work with the taxpayer to get payment, and exhausting any seizure remedies available if the taxpayer is uncooperative. And as something to provide context here, since 1994, we have done precisely 48 license suspension actions on some 1.4 million taxpayers and 120,000 businesses. So we're talking about rare circumstances that we actually use suspension action. And again, it's our last-ditch effort to gain compliance. The typical situation is when a taxpayer has made themselves judgment-proof by not owning any assets in their own name or receiving money in their own name. And so we really have no all avenues to gain compliance from them. Final approval of a license suspension request rests with the director, who must sign and approve each action. So we take it very seriously at the highest level of our agency. And in all circumstances, the taxpayer has already been given an appeal process and has either gone through the appeal process with the magistrate division of the tax court and the tax court, or has not requested an appeal. And thus, the assessments have become final and liquidated without their requesting an appeal. And in all circumstances, warrants have been issued as well. If the department makes the request, under 305-385, it directs the licensing agency to hold a hearing on license suspension. And the law states in part that upon the written request of the director and after a hearing and notice to the licensee, as required under any applicable provision of law, the agency, that would be the licensing agency, shall suspend the person's license if the agency finds that the returns and taxes have not been filed or paid. And generally what the information is that we provide is that there are assessments that have been made against this individual, and our information is prima facie evidence of that non-filing. And the other agency then does hold a hearing and provides the opportunity to discuss the issue, and we can intervene in those issues as well. During any and all of this time, the taxpayer can come to the Department of Revenue, work out payment arrangements, or pay the assessments, in which case then we will rescind, in effect, our license suspension request. And so I've attached a suggested amendment, and with apologies to Representative Jensen for not having an opportunity to get anything to him on that. It wasn't until late Wednesday when I discovered that this might apply to us. And the department, as I had mentioned, is exempted from several provisions of the APA, and our Attorney General did identify, though, that depending on the placement of this bill, it could become applicable to the Department of Revenue. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? This, I have one question. This applies to the relying upon opinions, recommendations, or findings of another agency. Does the department rely on that from other agencies?
Not from other agency. We would be the other agency in this circumstance. As an example, we might go to the Board of Dentistry or something if we have a dentist who is not complying with Oregon's tax laws and request that they suspend that person's license. And so then they would go through the process of a hearing. And and then the affected licensee could then work with us during that process and get the debts taken care of.
So you would be the agency B?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony. Richard Whitman.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name's Richard Whitman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to talk this morning about HB 2634. It appears from the testimony that you've heard, and as you've heard from that testimony, that the purpose of this bill is to ensure that a person seeking a license has the right to challenge an opinion, a recommendation, or a factual finding made by another agency where the license applicant doesn't agree with that opinion, recommendation, or factual finding. I don't think there's any problem with the purpose of this legislation. The problem is with, I think, some unintended consequences of it, or some issues relating to unintended consequences. First of all, as Mr. Hendricks said in response to a question, if a licensing agency is going to rely on information from a second agency in making a decision on a license, that information does have to be made part of the record, and it is subject to challenge by the license applicant. The Oregon Administrative Procedures Act already provides that if the license applicant doesn't agree with that opinion or factual finding, that they can challenge that in the contested case on the license or the license revocation. So there's already a process in the Oregon APA for a license applicant to challenge an opinion of a second agency if it's in fact being relied on to deny that license or to revoke that license. The second issue with regard to this bill has to do with judicial review. Right now, under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, if a license applicant is denied or their license is revoked and they have a contested case before the licensing agency, they have an opportunity to appeal that decision, that denial, to the Oregon Court of Appeals. This bill, by creating a right to a second contested case in front of the agency whose information is relied on by the licensing agency, would lead to a second decision in a contested case. So we'd have a decision by the licensing agency, and then we'd have another decision by the agency making a recommendation. Those decisions would occur at different points in time, but would both be appealable to the Oregon Court of Appeals. And the appeal would essentially concern or could potentially concern the same facts, the same legal issues, and it's not clear from this bill how that would get sorted out if we had two appeals going to the Court of Appeals at different times concerning the same issues. The third issue with regard to this bill is concerns situations where licensing agencies have statutes that require them to act within a particular amount of time, and that's fairly common. For instance, the Energy Facility Siting Council, which relies heavily on recommendations from other agencies, is required to act on applications for energy facilities within a particular amount of time. Again, this bill, by providing a right to a second contested case, would require the licensing agency to basically put everything on hold while the second contested case is going on. That, potentially at least, conflicts with time limits on the licensing agency making its decision. And it's not, again, not clear how that would get sorted out. The final issue that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is with regard to the fiscal impact of this bill. A fiscal impact has not been done on this yet. We have started looking at it along with agencies that would be subject to this, but it does appear that there would be at least some fiscal impact. I'm not prepared to quantify that right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Little? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this case today, House Bill 2634? Can I talk about this letter real quick? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You'll see passed out a letter from the State Offices for Services to Children and Families talking about some concerns that they have in terms of implications for their ability to do their job. And I talked to representatives from SCF and other representatives from the Department of Human Services, all concerned about the implications that this, unintended implications that this bill would have on their agency, both from a fiscal standpoint and just on the idea that it may cause agencies to stop sharing information so that they don't subject themselves to this requirement.
Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2634. We are not going into work session today. Open the hearing on House Bill 2009. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2009 comes to you from Representative Simmons. And the proponents have proposed the Dash 1 amendments that you should have in your packet. What those do is significantly limit the original changes that the bill made, and the main things that the bill would now do with Dash 1 amendments would be to raise the cap on prizes that may be awarded in bingo or lotto games from $1,500 to $2,500. And also permit bingo licensees to operate two games per year with a $10,000 prize per game. I have received information that there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay. Okay, John Michael.
Madam Chair, John Nichols, today representing the Disabled American Veterans Bingo Hall in Portland, and the five. I guess you would call them subcontractors who also run bingo games out of there, which include the Middleman Jewish Community Center, Portland State Vikings, which is their football booster group, organization called Peninsula Wrestling, which encourages inner city kids into more productive activities than sometimes they get into. Adults and children with learning disabilities, and the Oregon State Rifle Association. I won't take up a lot of time because a lot of people here, but basically this bill does three things. One, and the Dash 1 amendments kind of screwed this up, so I believe Mr. Laburn will speak to that, but first thing it does is allow bingo hall operators to contract out food and beverage services rather than being forced to furnish them in-house. People who run bingo halls usually have neither the training or the interest necessary to operate an economical snack bar. As a result, food service often becomes a losing proposition to drain revenues from the nonprofit. We spoke about the raise of the cap. That purpose of this is to allow bingo halls to compete with the Indian casinos and the games in the state of Washington, which have no caps on the prizes. And third, it will allow bingo managers to temporarily substitute for another manager within the same hall during vacations, emergencies, and illnesses. It will also allow a bingo manager to work as a game supervisor for another game in the same hall. The reason for this change is that there simply are not enough people with manager's licenses to fill the need for managers. And other than that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Laburn.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Ross Laburn. I'm an assistant attorney general. I also serve as attorney in charge of the department's charitable activities section. That section is responsible for carrying out the attorney general's regulatory function under ORS Chapter 464, the regulation of charitable bingo, raffles, and Monte Carlo. Bingo is a significant fundraising event for a number of charities. We have anywhere from 250 to 300 licensees in any given year, but it is not a growth industry. Beginning with about 1994, the bingo handle, that the amount taken in by the charities or the amount bet by the players, peaked in Oregon. It's been declining at about 2.5 million, I would say, on average since that time. And so Mr. Nichols and some other licensees came to the department earlier this year with some proposals as some concepts, I think, to improve their ability to continue to make money for their various respective charitable programs. As committee counsel told you, we felt that initially some of those concepts as embodied in the original bill went too far, but the concepts that Mr. Nichols outlined, the three concepts that are generally provided for in the Dash 1 amendments, the department has no opposition to. We think that they're modest changes. We think that they will enhance the opportunities of the licensees to continue to operate profitably their bingo operations. My one quarrel, I guess, with the Dash 1 amendments is that if you, in the original bill, on page 2, there were some changes to the definition of operating expenses, and they appear twofold. One, a deletion in line 29 of the term and related concessions, and then later on lines 41, 42, that language gets added back in. The concept here is that at least in terms of what Mr. Nichols and I think the licensees are trying to accomplish, is I think we need to take that language back out of lines 41 and 42, which the Dash 2 amendments or Dash 1 amendments would do. But the Dash 1 amendments also essentially restore this whole provision, ORS 167.117, to its original status. And I believe that in order to accomplish what Mr. Nichols wants to accomplish, we need to continue to delete and related concessions in line 29. So that's just a further technical amendment that I think that is necessary to the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. All right. We will have questions of the panel when we take the other person's testimony here, so go ahead.
I'm Greg Hitchcock. I'm on the member of a board of directors, Willamette Valley Track and Field. We conduct a bingo game down in Eugene. Also, as a lawyer, I've represented numerous nonprofit organizations in the conducting of their bingo games, and they're generally in favor of this bill. I don't think you have to worry about prizes dramatically increasing. I think when the prize was bumped from $750 to $1,500, it's rare to see a $1,500 prize go. Most games, I believe, cap out at just under the IRS reporting amount of $1,200. That's what the players like. That's what the bingo games offer. Yeah. So you will see larger prizes advertised, but you can adjust the odds on bingo games so that they may not be awarded, that there'll be a lesser prize awarded if the bingo game doesn't go in a certain amount of numbers. And that's how we would see the $10,000 prize operating, is that people would advertise that like they do up in Washington or the Indian casinos do, but that it would be on a long odds type of game, and so it would rarely go. And I think we can work with the department in terms of ensuring that when it does go, there is $10,000 there to be awarded to the bingo player. And there is a need to have managers be able to back up other groups, because what can happen is you need to have a bingo manager to run your game. If you don't have a licensed bingo manager, you can't have a bingo game. So you're kind of held hostage sometimes by your bingo manager if they want to quit all of a sudden. What a lot of groups do is they have a board member get a backup bingo manager's license, but the board member, like myself, I wouldn't know how to run a bingo game. And so you're kind of at the mercy of having somebody kind of hold your hand through the bingo sessions anyway, and this just takes away, I guess, some of the fiction there and allows an adjustment period in those situations, as well as allowing somebody competent to run the game when your bingo manager goes on vacation. So those are my comments.
Okay, any questions of this panel? Representative Ringo.
I've never been to a bingo hall. But my question is, do people get addicted to bingo like they do to other forms of gambling?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Ringo. Bingo is more of a social event than it is gambling. Nationwide, the industry estimates there are 65 million people play bingo on a regular basis. It's normally your older crowd, or the people on disability, or work nights, or whatever. In our hall, for example, the minimum buy-in is $4. That gives the morning session, afternoon session. That means for a total of $8, they can have 30 chances to win $80. The people come in, it's more of, as I said, it's more of a social event. They'll sit in the same chairs, they'll play cards beforehand, get something to eat. It's a real socialization process, particularly for elderly people, and it's not that expensive for them.
I'm sorry, I guess that really didn't answer my question, though, whether there are some people that are addicted to it. In the same sense as
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, quite frankly, the hardcore gambler either spends his money on video poker or he goes to the Indian casinos. We don't see them in a bingo hall.
Some follow-up?
Representative Ringo?
I don't understand. If the primary focus is social, if it's you pay your $8 so you get, you know, however many games, why is it necessary to raise the prize amount?
Bingo profitability is really on the margins. And so if by offering a slightly higher prizes or enticing people with this kind of long odd shot, you can get just 5 or 10 more people to come to your bingo game in addition to the 200 or so that are there. On an annual basis, that can add $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 of net fundraising for the organization. And so that's what this is designed to, is to attract people on the margins. You know, do we go out to the Indy casinos? Do we cross the bridge and go up to the Vancouver games? And you're just trying to convince 5, 10 of those people to...
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I mean, it seems to me that at least then you are acknowledging the financial incentive. That it is an important part, and it's important enough for you to be here today.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, if I may, John Nichols again. Bingo is a very expensive thing to run. About 65 to 70% of the money that comes in goes directly back out in prizes. The state law limits bingo operations to 18% expenses, requires that 5% at minimum must go to the charity, and our good friends at the Justice Department get 0.0095 of the gross. So there isn't a heck of a lot of money there to play with, and if nonprofits are to be able to survive using bingo as a fundraiser, we've got to have a little bit of incentive to get people in.
Another question? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. John Helen and Chuck Reynolds, or Richard, excuse me, Chuck Richard.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Helen, and I am also the executive director of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association. The OCGA is an association of not-for-profit organizations who are licensed to conduct the bingo, raffle, and Monte Carlo licenses here in Oregon under the Oregon Charitable Activities Law. And we are here to urge your support of House Bill 2009. If I could, I'd quickly like to address Representative Ringo's concerns, especially regarding the financial incentives. When you have Indian casinos that are buying buses and having them parked right outside our bingo halls and offering them free rides to the coast or to Grand Ronde and providing free food for them in order to allow them to get the money from these individuals who are part of our communities and that could be helping our nonprofits, certainly we are advocating for some incentive ability to keep people in our communities instead of shipping them out to the coast or to Grand Ronde on free buses. So there definitely is a need for us to be able to give people a reason to stay in their communities and support the nonprofits that then turn around and support those same communities. There are 287, from last information we have, 287 bingo licensees in Oregon, and most of the bingo licensees that will benefit from this bill will be the Class A licensees, which are the larger games. They're the ones that have more hours of operation. They're the ones who offer more routine games and are the ones who generate the income from the general public, as opposed to membership organizations for your Class B, C, and Ds, like your Elks Lodges, your Moose Lodges, and those types of things. I have some testimony I can pass out to you, but I wanted to make sure that you understand the types of nonprofits that are going to be benefiting and be able to stay viable under this bill. You have 15 American Legion posts across the state, 19 VFW chapters, over 30 Elks Lodges, over 30 Eagles Lodges, Gold Beach Senior Center, the Grant County Senior Citizens, Lower Umpqua Community Center, Oregon Sports Academy, Neighborhood Health Clinics, National Fibromyalgia Research Association, and the list goes on. There are lots of wonderful not-for-profit organizations in Oregon that need this bill to maintain their viability with the Washington State Games and with the Indian tribes. And with that, I would just make this one last note. Senate Bill 626 flew through both the House and the Senate, and both Senate and House Judiciary Committees, and it essentially lifted the limit on income that could be earned by the Salem Boys and Girls Club. And we would just like to have the same kind of consideration for our bingo games, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Richards. I'm the president of the Oregon Sports Academy. We have been bingo licensee for 16 years. We play in Beaverton at Sunset Bingo. Just a couple comments. One, we're certainly supportive of the bill and the amendments. Being in the business for 16 years, you find a changing landscape, and it's been handled through administrative rules as well as here and statute development. But the competitive aspect of the game has certainly become a little bit more difficult, and this allows us in some ways to compete with the Indian casinos and the games in Washington a bit more than we've been able to perhaps in the past. The other, addressing Representative Ringo's comments, we just surveyed our players in February on a variety of matters. 2,000 of our players filled out that survey, and one of the questions asked was, you know, why do you come? What's most important? And I think they were given about 10 different boxes they could check, but the most important, as John Nichols pointed out, was kind of a social interaction, a break, something to do different, etc. They're not really there to win, and it's not so much the gambling. There aren't usually the pots are split multiple directions, like 5 ways, 10 ways. So the time you take a $1,500 payout is a couple hundred dollars, that sort of thing. So it's very much a social event with a gaming component that funds the various charities. So we're in support. Thank you. And this is Kit Freeman. She's the manager.
Good morning. My name is Kit Freeman. I am a bingo manager, have been since 1988. As a bingo manager, what concerns us is we have to have a backup manager. There has to be a bingo manager to operate. Myself personally, in 13 years, I've actually had 3 medical situations that have come up that I could not seek medical attention because I could not leave. A bingo manager has to be present. By allowing another bingo manager to step in those situations, there would have never been an issue. And currently, the way it reads, that cannot happen. So it would be nice to be able to allow, there have been people who could have done my job for me, but they are licensed managers for another organization that operates at Sunset Bingo, but they're not allowed to step in. And by allowing that to happen, it would just alleviate a lot of the problems that we have where you have to make a decision between medical attention or whether or not a bingo session continues to run, because if you leave, the doors close.
Thank you. Any questions, or panel?
Just one other comment. Our licenses enable us to play bingo for only 15 hours a week, and so when we open our doors, that's the maximum we can play, and so we have to kind of do all our business. As John pointed out, there are a lot of expenses and a lot of things are undertaken in those 15 hours, and so to have some sort of an attractive banner and a potential winning is part of the menu that we need to kind of throw out there to attract people and kind of get it done. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Okay. In view of the fact that we have some work on some amendments here, I'm not going to go into work session today. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2009, and we are adjourned today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I apologize about the dog. I wish she could have...